walk alone. Step by step.
Primary Purpose Big Book Study Group's Thursday Night Alcoholics and God Speaker Step Series. I'm a recovered alcoholic. My name is Roy. Thanks for joining us tonight. In a minute, we're going to start our two-minute meditation. So please take a moment to get situated. Please turn off all devices that make noise or that might, will distract others. Take this time to get connected to God. Let the craziness of the day drift away and ask God to help you stay focused on the step study tonight. Is everybody ready? If so, let's start the meditation. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. I've asked Theory to read Appendix 2, Spiritual Experience. We read this because the main purpose of the 12 steps is to have one, so it's kind of important to know what one is. Please refrain from disturbing others by talking or constantly getting up and sitting back down. Theory, come up and read the spiritual experience.
Theory, recovered alcoholic. The terms spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which, upon careful reading, shows that the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself among us in many different forms. Yet it is true that our first printing gave many readers the impression that these personality changes or religious experience must be in the nature of sudden and spectacular upheavals. Happily for everyone, this conclusion is erroneous. In the first few chapters, a number of sudden revolutionary changes are described. Though it is not our intention to create such an impression, Many alcoholics nevertheless concluded that in order to recover, they must require an immediate and overwhelming God consciousness, followed at once by a vast change in feeling and outlook. Among our rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformations, though frequent, are by no means the rule. Most of our experiences are what the psychologist William James calls the educational variety, because they develop slowly over a period of time. Quite often, friends of the newcomer are aware of the difference long before he is himself. He finally realizes that he has undergone a profound alteration in his reaction to life, that such a change could hardly have been brought about by himself alone. What often takes place in a few months could seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. With few exceptions, our members find that they have tapped an unsuspected inner resource, which they presently identify with their own conception of a higher power greater than themselves. Most of us think this awareness of a power greater than ourselves is the essence of a spiritual experience. Our more religious members call it God consciousness. Most emphatically, we wish to say that any alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover, provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. We find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery, but these are indispensable. There is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation.
We're going to do the fog light prayer. If you don't know it, it's right here on the sign, or there's cards that are in the pews in front of you. God, let your love shine through me like a fog light, so those who are lost, sick, and dying can find your love through me. Please refrain from disturbing others by talking or constantly getting up and sitting back down. This is a tech-free meeting, so set your phones to airplane meeting mode or just turn them off. Tonight we got Tom doing his ninth session here. Each week is something new, something exciting, and he shares his story. You hear a lot of things over and over, but he said last week he can't make up a new story. He's not going to lie. It's been an experience thus far, so help me welcome Tom.
Good evening. How is everybody tonight?
Good.
Good. My name's Tom. I'm an alcoholic. Where to start? Let's start here. This is from Father John Doe's book, Sobriety and Beyond, on page 43. John Doe is talking about a retreat master. He said, a retreat master once said, the price of real maturity in life is a realization of the mistakes we have made. You young men will be really mature the day you look back on your life and cry out, my God, what a mess I've made of things. That day will be a great day for you. But it will be a great day, too, when only a deep humility will enable you, despite the mess of the past, to go forward and do life's work. It is easy enough for the years when life's blood is coursing through our veins to rush on and on from day to day, from week to week, and even from year to year, taking each new task in its stride. But then sooner or later, unless we fail to learn humility, the day of awakening comes. It may come with a blinding flash that seems to tear away the very foundations of life. But it must come if we are ever to mature. My God, what a mess I've made of things. As I look back, how pitiful is the good done? How sparing my help to others. How innumerable my mistakes, the wrongs. How all-pervading my self-seeking. How seamy the finished product. Is such realization discouraging? Absolutely. Unless I fall on my knees and humbly admit it all to God, with a heartfelt thanks that He knows and understands and will make allowance, full allowance, for my pitiful human frailty. What else could He or I expect? Then from my knees I arise and face the future, trusting far less in myself than ever before, and throwing my full weight on God, knowing that it will be an easy burden for His omnipotence. You know, you probably wonder, well, why do you bring that up, you know, in the ninth step? Maybe you don't. I don't know. That's because I take God into everything with me. You know, and that's the way I was taught, to take God into making my amends. I don't do anything on my own. I do everything with God. That's the way that I was taught from the very beginning of my training. And that's what this is. It's training. It's training to train me to learn how to do what's written in this book, okay? When you get to where you're talking about the ninth step in the big book, page 77. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. There it is. You know, what did I do? My whole life, all I ever did was cry, 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 what about Tom? Tom, 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 Tom. You know, yeah, I do repeat myself a lot because it's the same story. You know, the same story, you know. I don't know who you think about all day, but I know who I think about. I think about me. I wake up in the morning thinking about me, and I go to bed at night thinking about me, and the only time I think about you is how it relates to me. I can't get away from this self. That's the problem with my alcoholism. And the only way that I can do that is to constantly remember that that's who I am. I am who I am, like Popeye used to say. I am who I am, and that's all that I am. You know, and that's the way that I have to approach everything within the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, because it's so easy for me. So easy for me to fall into rationalization and justification, to soothe my conscience, to minimize my guilt, for me to come up with reasons, okay? Reasons why, that's why it talks about, that's why it talks about that. You know, the big book, it may be a little bit lacking when it comes to the seventh and eighth step and the sixth step. But when it comes to the ninth step, the big book's pretty good on the ninth step. They put some heavy suggestions in there. I think that's why in the 12 and 12, why they went kind of light, you know, in the 12 and 12. I go into 12 and 12, and in step 9, and what do I see? Come here. I know it's in here someplace. Here you go. There's one paragraph that I really like, and that's where it starts off. It says, after we made the list of people we have harmed, have reflected carefully upon each instance, and have tried to possess ourselves of the right attitude in which to proceed, we will see that the making of direct amends divides those we should approach into several classes. And, you know, I'm going to have a long discussion on this tonight, simply because of what the ninth step says. The ninth step says, make direct amends. You know, there's a lot to think about here in this ninth step. I am a person who likes to expand my thought upon the steps, and I'm not alone. Ever since, you know, these steps were written, there have been people who have been expanding their ideas on just exactly what these steps are about. Now, it's very easy to just look at the ninth step and say, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Like, that's so simple. But it's not. It's not that simple. Not when we really start to get into it. And even though the 12 and 12 wasn't written until 1952, they started to understand by 1952, when the 12 and 12 was written, that the ninth step's about more than just making direct amends. After we made a list of people that we had harmed and have reflected carefully upon each instance and have tried to possess ourselves of the right attitude in which to proceed, we will see that the making of direct amends divides those we should approach into several classes. Right away, it's already not so simple anymore, because now we're talking about several classes. There will be those who ought to be dealt with just as soon as we become reasonably confident that we can maintain our sobriety. That may be before we even get to the ninth step. There will be those to whom we can make only partial restitution, lest complete disclosures do them or others more harm than good. That takes a lot of reflection. It takes time to come to that understanding. There will be other cases where action ought to be deferred. And still others in which, by the very nature of the situation, we shall never be able to make direct personal contact. I talked a lot about my feelings because that's what this is about. It's about my feelings. And if I don't like the way that I feel, and I'm not happy about the way I'm feeling, I need to change the way that I think. Because my feelings are directly connected to my thinking. Or if you are religious or you've read the Bible before, you know that there's a piece that talks about as a man thinketh. That's what he is. As he thinketh, that's what he is. So if I don't like the way that I feel, then I need to change the way that I think. And I was trained in AA this way by a man, the man that I previously, you know, in the past steps have talked about, the man who put my hand in God's hand, taught me that we can't think our way into good living. We have to live our way into good thinking. This is about action. Action is the key. What is the action that I'm going to take? Always the action that I take with me into everything is the action of taking God into it with me. It's always asking myself about what my motives are. Because my motives are, you know, I can cover up. I can cover up those motives. I can always cover up a bad one with a good one. I can always fool myself into things because of my alcoholism. I have to always remember that I suffer from a mind-powered disease. It's a thinking disease. And it's a talking disease. It talks to me. It talks to me and it tells me all kinds of stories. My mind is real good at making up stories. By about the time I got here, I started to realize, you know, that I was a big jerk. I started to realize, you know, that I didn't treat people very nicely. You know, as I've shared in the past steps, you know, in the past discussions, if you've been here listening to me, you know, I was a very arrogant, obnoxious, aggressive, loud-mouthed drunk that would jump down your throat with both boots to prove you were wrong and I was right. And that's all that mattered. That's why we talked so much last week on the eighth step about forgiveness. That's why my sponsor taught me, you know, to make a list of people who owed me amends. Not a list of people that I owed amends to. He wouldn't allow me to do that until I made the list of people that I believed owed amends to me, so that I could learn to forgive. Because after all, I can't be forgiven if I can't forgive myself. And I'm right there. You know, God forgives me. Who am I not to forgive myself? Understand that I'm a human being. This isn't about perfection. It's about progress. But perfection is what the goal is. Even though I will never become perfect, it's my God who is perfect. My failures glorify my God. The reason I say that is because of God's love for me. God's love for me is infinite. It has no conditions. I'm not capable of that kind of love. And because of all my failures, and I'm a human being who continues to fail, you know what? My God still loves me. How many of us are capable of doing that with another human being? That's why I don't apologize to anybody for my complete and total dependence upon a power greater than myself. Because I'm sober by the mercy of God. No man got me sober. No sponsor got me sober. I don't get anybody sober. Nobody got me sober. I'm sober by the mercy of God. And I stay sober by the grace of God. I had a good friend named Joe Holland, died several years ago. Joe was a great guy. Joe used to say, you know what? I didn't get justice, I got mercy. And that's what I got. I didn't get justice. If I'd have got justice, I'd still be in the penitentiary. But I got mercy. Mercy and God's grace. I live in a state of grace. And all that grace is God's unmerited love. I don't even merit that love, but God gives it to me anyway. Because He's God, and I'm not. And that's why I depend upon my God, because he'll never fail me. I'm not dependent on drugs or alcohol or people, places, and things. You see, my problem, and if you got the problem that I got, my problem is unhealthy dependencies. That's how I come to alcohol and drugs. Like I shared before, alcohol didn't make me an alcoholic. Drugs didn't make me a drug addict. Those were the things that I used as the medication for my alcoholism. And once we stop using drugs and alcohol, all of a sudden all the other unhealthy dependencies start to come out. Or what they like to call the seven deadly sins. The question of how to approach the man we hated will arise. Damn, I got to go to the man I hated. It may be he has done us more harm than we have done him. Now I see why my sponsor had me do what he had me do. And though we may have acquired a better attitude toward him, we're still not too keen about admitting our faults. Just like when it talks about in the beginning, who cares to admit complete defeat? Who cares to admit fault? Even to ourselves. And this society is, you know, I mean, this is a great for a society to keep on lying. Just keep lying. Even when you're caught red-handed, just lie. That's what they do in the corporate world. Or get an attorney to lie for you. And I was a terrible liar. You know, I come to this, I start to realize what a liar I am. You know, I mean, I was a real bullshit artist, okay? I was always telling stories all the time. Trying to impress people all the time. You know? And I started to see that. I had been telling some lies for so long that I started to believe that they were the truth. Sober and working through the steps, after about a couple of years, you know, I mean, it took me a couple of years before I got to the ninth step. I started seeing, you know, you're just full of crap, man, you know, and it bothered me. I'm not an employment agency. I'm just another drunk who's trying to stay sober. And all I can do with you is to share with you my experience, strength, and hope. That's all I can do. And I can't tell you what you need to do. You need to figure that out. But I'll tell you this. I need to feel. For me to change, I need to feel. Maybe some people, listen, some people do need to have medication. Well, some medication is so strong, I don't know how they feel. And I don't know how the AA program can work on somebody who can't feel, who's so dead from medication that they can't feel what's going on. Because that's the way the steps work for me, is they open me up. They made my feelings aware to me. And I started to realize what a mess I made of things, just like the piece I just read to you about. what a mess I made of things, and how I needed to amend me. Now, that's not saying I'm sorry. I'm sorry, but it's not saying I'm sorry. I said I was sorry my whole life. I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. Oh, I'm a liar. I'm sorry. You know what he told me? He says, you don't like lying? I says, no. He says, you know how you fix that? I said, no, how do you fix that? He said, when you're talking to somebody and you start realizing that you're lying to them because, and he knew it, this is exactly what was happening to me. I was realizing that I was telling them a lie. He said, when you realize that you're telling that person a lie, you have to stop right then and say, oh, wait a minute. Excuse me. That crap I was just telling you, it was all a lie. I said, you must be crazy. I'm talking to somebody, and I realize I'm lying to them, and you want me to stop and tell them that I was lying to them? That's crazy, man. He said, you want to stop lying? You do that, and you'll stop lying. If you have to do that, if you make that commitment to yourself that you're, you know, because that's what this is about, see? Are you willing to go to any lengths or not? You know, there's a lot of people that run around thinking that Alcoholics Anonymous, well, some of these people are so harsh. You had to be harsh with me. No other way works with me but being harsh. I'm sorry. But a pat on the ass is not going to work. It doesn't work with me. It never did. Maybe it works with some people. But you think I want to go to somebody who I think did stuff to me and I'm supposed to go to them and make amends? Well, the way that I was set up for it ahead of time in the eighth step was helping me to do that. It was helping me to go there. Nevertheless, with a person we dislike, we take the bit in our teeth. It is harder to go to an enemy than to a friend. It's easy to go to your friends. Your friends are going to forgive you. What's your enemy going to do? Maybe you're scared your enemy won't forgive you. Who are you worried about? You worried about your enemy? Are you worried about your own ass? I don't know who you think about all day, but I think about me. It's harder to go to an enemy than to a friend, but we find it much more beneficial to us. Oh, we're going to get benefit. We're going to get a lot of benefit out of doing that. It's more beneficial to us. We go to him in a helpful and forgiving spirit, confessing a forgiven spirit. We've already forgiven him. We're going to him in a forgiving spirit. We're ready to go to our enemy and forgive whatever he's done and going to ask him, you know, to let go of what we did to him. Can you see the spirituality that's involved in this? Under no condition do we criticize such a person or argue. Argue about, oh, well, you did worse than I did. Oh, you know, I was always great for that. You know, somebody always did worse than me. Okay? Especially women. Under no condition do we criticize such a person. Simply we tell him that we will never get over drinking until we have done our utmost to straighten out the past. We are there to sweep off our side of the street. That's where this comes from, about taking care of my side of the street. It's not about taking care of somebody else's side of the street. It's about taking care of my side of the street. Cleaning my side of the street is what's important. Not the other guy cleaning his side of the street. That's his problem. A guy I was talking to today, he goes, well, you know, Tom, this is in business. He says, some of those guys are talking bad about you. I said, well, it's okay. He goes, really? I go, yeah, because what other people got to say about me ain't none of my business. It ain't none of my business. I'm not in that business about what you think about me. I'm in the business of what I think about me and what my God thinks about me. That's the business I'm in. Realizing that nothing worthwhile can be accomplished until we do so, never trying to tell him what he should do, our faults are not discussed. We stick to our own. If our own manner is calm, frank, and open, we will be gratified with the results. Most alcoholics owe money. You don't dodge your creditors. If you owe money, you pay it. We have to lose fear of our creditors. No matter how far we have to go, we are liable to drink if we are afraid to face them. Perhaps we've committed a criminal offense, which might land us in jail if we were known to the authorities. But I've been through this over and over with guys, okay? And a few girls, too. If they got a warrant for you, if they know that you committed a crime, you're going to have to face it sooner or later. You might have to go to jail. You won't be the first one that went to jail and stayed sober. And a lot of them that I know have gone to jail, even started AA meetings in jail. Now, I committed all kinds of crimes, but there wasn't any warrant. Nobody knew that I did that crime. Was I supposed to go and start confessing? No. What good's that going to do? And I knew that. And I had, I didn't have a problem with making direct amends directly to the people that I needed to make direct amends to. And I know who those people were. Mainly those are my family. Where I started getting messed up is I started getting messed up in this criminal stuff. Because not only was I a drug addict and an alcoholic, but I was a criminal too. I was a criminal for a long time. And I did a lot of criminal stuff. And I hurt a lot of people. A lot of nameless, faceless people that I did things to. Now, how do you make direct amends? How are you going to make direct amends to nameless, faceless people? But you feel it. You got that dirt in you. And it needs to be cleaned out. And I went to my sponsor. This is where sponsors come in. This is where sponsors are important. I went to my sponsor and I says, well, what am I supposed to do? You remember how I talked about in the 8-step, he had me write everybody on the list? All the bartenders, all the cops, all the waitresses, all the people that I screwed over in dope deals and stuff. People I turned into junkies. I turned a lot of people into junkies. Why do you think he had me write that down on that list for? Because when I asked him that question, when we got to the 9th step, and I asked him that question about, well, what am I, I can't make direct amends. He said, well, who said you can't make amends? And I said, well, the step says make direct amends. How am I supposed to do that? I don't know these people. He said,
you're going to make amends. I'm confused. I'm going, well, how am I supposed to make amends? What kind of amends? He said, you're going to make spiritual amends. And God's going to show you how that's done. And my God has been showing me how that's done for years. Because you think this amends, you think that this making amends is about something that we just once do and it's over? Because it's not. This is a lifetime process. It's not just something that I do. This is what I call, and what Bob Anderson taught me, what I talked about before, is the application of the step in my life. Oh, I know, and even Father John Doe, lots of people talk about 1 through 9, you do them one time, and then it's 10, 11, and 12. Nah, it's, this stuff is ongoing. Do you do just the first step just one day? One day I just do the first step, I never do the first step again the rest of my life? No! Do I just do the second step one day, and then I never do it again the rest of my life? No! Do I do the third step just one day, and I never do it again the rest? No! These are steps through application, constantly, all the time. Yeah, I know, you can read Father John Doe, say people who say they do all 12 steps every day are crazy. He says that. But there's a whole lot of people that talk me. Yeah, maybe I don't do all 12 steps every day in a formal way. Let's not get carried away. All right? We can split hairs. Play games. It's about application. What's going on in my life? What step applies? What step do I apply to that situation? Okay? So am I still making amends? Sure I am. I'm still changing, aren't I? Amends is not about saying I'm sorry. Amends is about changing my life. I mend, amend, fix, change. Don't be the same. Do something different. That takes action. And I bring my God into everything. I said, you know, like I said, some of the biggest direct amends are the amends that we make to our families. Because those amends, you know, that we directly hurt the people that we love the most. I talked a lot about that in the past weeks. You know, I talked last week about how I came to the door, knocked on the door. My own mother looked in my face and didn't even know who I was. Didn't even recognize her own son. The pain that I caused my family, you know, my brother, my sister, my mother, my father, they were the ones that I directly hurt the most. And my father was, I tell you the story, my father's long dead now. He lived to 91. My mother's gone too. But my father was an adult. My father was a child of an alcoholic. My grandfather, his father, and my sister is sober. I mentioned this before, 34 years. I'm sober 33. She's my little sister, 4 years younger than me. I took her to her first meeting. Then I went and got drunk. I was in my years of being around. Not in. And I talked to you about how I hadn't seen my father in a long time, and he came. I'm getting ready to be sentenced to the Illinois Penitentiary. You know, and I hadn't seen my father in a couple of years, and he comes walking in the courtroom. Just as I'm getting ready to get sentenced. He made it in the nick of time. Came all the way from Florida. with an attorney. They go up and talk to the judge and go and sit down. The judge calls me up and says, well, you know, you got two choices. You can go to the Illinois Penitentiary or you can go to Florida with your father. I said, well, I guess I'm going to Florida. And don't ever come back to Illinois, or that's exactly where we're going to put you, is in the penitentiary. I said, okay, you got a deal, Judge. You got a deal. I'll take that deal. You know, I still wasn't ready to get sober. I still was a tornado. So I come down here, what, four more years I was a tornado, ripping up everything and everybody. No, and like I talked about, my father, he could be there for you. But he was not the kind of guy, he was not a hugging kind of guy, he was not a I love you kind of guy. He was a tough little Irishman. He was a B-17 bombardier in the Second World War. He flew 35 missions over Germany. All of them suicide missions. He wasn't afraid of nothing or nobody. And my old Irish grandmother, she wouldn't divorce my grandfather, you know, because we don't believe in divorce. And me and my sister were trying to talk to him before, you know, about how alcoholism is a family disease. And he would tell you, well, my father's drinking didn't affect me because mother wouldn't allow him home if he was drinking. In other words, my grandfather was a periodic alcoholic. He was a barber. He had a barber shop. And he'd just lock the barber shop up, and then he'd go live on Skid Row for several months. And my father would see his father sleeping in doorways and shit on Skid Row. But you couldn't convince him that alcoholism affected him. He was kind of a rageaholic. I wonder if the alcoholism had anything to do with that. He hated his father. He went to his grave hating him for his alcoholism, for what he'd done to his family. In the end, he would come and sit with me, you know, the last couple few years of his life and try to find a way to forgive his father. He would sit with me and he would say things like, how would you feel if your mother made nothing but $12 a week and you should give me a dollar a day to buy the groceries and you see him sneaking in the house in the middle of the night drunk and hiding his money in the register in the floor? How would you feel? How'd you feel if some kid told you they seen your old man being hauled off by the cops, all beat up, put in a paddy wagon and stuff? How would you feel about that? What are you going to tell him? You should forgive him? It'd be good for you to do that? You know what one of my father's favorite sayings to say to me all the time was? You're a bum. I wonder where he got that from. You're a bum. You're going to be a bum. You're nothing but a bum. He used to say to me, you know, the only thing you do right is go to work. That's because I wanted the money from the paycheck, but I'd be broke on Monday morning. You see, I wasn't somebody that could be counted on. I was just like his father. He looked at me, his son, and saw his father, a bum who couldn't be counted on. Okay. And so I says to my sponsor, you know, I says, I don't know how to talk to this guy, but I need to make amends to him, you know. And my sponsor said, well, write him a letter. And so I did. I wrote this letter, man. It was like 3 pages long, you know. I poured my heart out to him about how sorry I was and everything. And I went over to the house to see him. And he says, all right. I says, I got something for you, Dad. I want you to read. He said, okay. He says, come on in here. And He sat down and he opened the letter and he started reading the whole thing, and I sat there, and when he finished reading it, he folded it all up and he put it back in the envelope and he handed it to me, and he stood up and he said, "That's nice, Tom," and he walked out. And I was heartbroken. I went to my sponsor and I said, I don't understand. I don't see how he could have done that. How could he have done that? And my sponsor told me, he said, "Well, you know what, Tom?" He says, "You just learned a good lesson." I said, "What lesson did I learn?" He said, "Making amends is not about being forgiven. We don't do it so that people forgive us." You know, when the old man got old and he got a little bit crazy, you know, my mother called me and she said, "You know, you got to come over here. He's got $20,000 in cash sitting on the table. He does nothing but go to the bank every other day, worried like about his money. He's moving the money in different banks all the time. He's driving me nuts." And I went there to see him, you know, and he's sitting there staring at this pile of cash on the table. And he got some clarity, you know, and he said, I can't take this." I said, "I know." I said, "You let me take it. I'll give you a receipt." Oh, he wanted a receipt now. "And I'll take the bills. And I'll start taking care of everything." Because he'd go through all the mail, and he had mail all over the place and stuff. I says, "I'll take care of it." And for the last three, four years of his life, I took care of everything. I took care of them, my wife and I. And, you know, he got sick. He'd never been sick a day in his life. He hated hospitals. He hated doctors, you know. Hell, I had to take him to the hospital. He had to go in the hospital. He says, "I'm not staying here." I says, "You're staying. You got to stay." "I'm not staying. I'll hitchhike home." They caught him buck naked going out the lobby of the Boca Raton Hospital, you know. He had a pick that ran almost all the way to his heart. He pulled it out 9 times. They had to strap him down in his bed. He fought with all the nurses. They had to put him on Halidol, a chemical restraint. They had his hands all balled up like boxing mitts. And they called me. I was in Orlando at a meeting, and they called me and they said, "There's, you know, after a few weeks, there's nothing more we can do for him. And he should go to hospice." I said, "Okay, I'll be home. I'll meet the hospice person in the morning." So I came back from Orlando, and that morning I went up to the hospital, and I was meeting with the hospice person. And they had took him off the Halidol the night before because they knew he was going to hospice. And I went, I says, "I'm going to go in and talk to him." I went in, the room was kind of dark, you know, and he was laying there, and he had his hands were all balled up, you know, these mitts, and he's going, "Come here, come here." And I leaned over, and he looked me in the eye, and he said, "I'm done." And I said, "I know you are." I said, "I'm going to have you put someplace where nobody's going to bother you anymore. You're not going to have no tubes in you or anything else, and they'll leave you alone." He looked at me and he said, "I knew I could count on you." And I knew my amends were made. It took 28 years, but I knew that they were made that day. That's what making amends is about. About changing your life, not living the way that you used to live, not being a selfish, self-centered jerk who only thinks about me. That's how you do it. Thanks for letting me share it.
Let's thank Tom one more time. Ask Fred, the secretary, to come up.
Hi, my name is Fred, and I'm your recovered alcoholic secretary. In keeping with the seven traditions which states that every group shall be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions, the baskets are now going around. I've asked Marcus to read the recovered statement. We read this notice to explain why many people in this group identify as recovered rather than recovering, and what it exactly means to be a recovered alcoholic.
My name is Marcus. I'm an addict. Recovered. We are not cured of alcoholism. Recovered but not cured, that presents a conflict to some alcoholics. If we were cured, we would be able to drink responsibly. No, we are not cured. The allergic reaction to alcohol will remain with us for our lifetime. But we have been restored to sanity. That was the problem. The main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind, rather than in the body. We are now sane where alcohol is concerned. Consequently, we have recovered.
...1940 style big book sponsorship from the fourth to the second edition Alcoholics Anonymous. Of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, 50% got sober at once and remained that way, 25% sobered up after some relapses, and among the remainder, those who stayed on with AA showed improvement. What we've seen, felt, and come to believe and experience is that God has not changed over time, and neither should the sacred approach back to his loving arms. The statistics above suggest a 75% success rate. Can I have a show of hands of recovered alcoholics? Is there anyone in need of a sponsor tonight? Please raise your hand. Please join us Monday nights. We have a big book study meeting over on the other side in the Newman Center on the third floor, where the big book comes alive. Fellowship is at 6:30 and the meeting itself starts at 7:15. We have large print big book and big book dictionaries for sale. We meet every Thursday starting promptly at 7:15, and we ask that you be courteous and ready to begin at the sound of bells. Thank you guys, I'll see you next week.
I'd like to invite everyone to our Monday night big book study, and those whom wish to thank tonight's speaker, please line up down the center aisle. Let's close with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, see you all next Monday or next Thursday. Godspeed.
I'm not old, I just can't get you right. much accumulation. These possessions that I have amount to nothing at all.
And I hope